What's happening in the world when you put CO2 into it? If I emit CO2, and they've done some model experiments with this, which are interesting, put CO2 in. Well, if you have an excess in the atmosphere above the chemical equilibrium of the ocean, some of it spreads into the mixed layer of the ocean. If you have a higher CO2 level, that in certain circumstances, when there's water and nutrients, helps terrestrial biology, plants grow more. And so what we have recognized all through this rising situation of emissions is about half of what's emitted stays in the atmosphere, and about a quarter goes into the terrestrial biosphere, and a quarter goes into the mixed layer of the ocean. So that's sort of an initial redistribution that occurs over relatively short periods. The oceans are changing temperature, they take up CO2, they put it back. And so that's a relatively short-term adjustment. But once it's emitted, that sort of comes into balance for past emissions. And so you can have some reduction as new emissions sort of do that adjustment, but that doesn't take you very far. After that, where does the CO2 go? Well, there's a pretty long time constant for it to go into the roots and the permanent storage on land and carbon. And it's pretty slow mixing into the deep ocean. In fact, that was something that was a criticism of Arrhenius at the time when he proposed saying CO2 could go up. People said, well, look how much CO2 is in the ocean. It'll all get taken up by the ocean. We don't have to worry. It'll take a long time. And it took until the 1950s and some atmospheric nuclear testing and other things that let scientists, Roger Revelle, and who was the teacher of Al Gore and others, look at how radionuclides, radioactive carbon-14 and things, went into the ocean. And it turned out there is this mixed layer. It's only 100, 200 meters deep, and that gets mixed by the weather, the winds and everything mix it. But to go below that, you have to go down in the sinking water is in the polar regions, the very cold, dense polar regions will go down. And they only go down to a certain extent. And it turns out it really helps when you have sea ice formation and not making really salty water to go deeper. And as they go down, the water in the most of the ocean gets pushed up. And so any CO2 that is trying to diffuse down gradually through the layers of the ocean gets pushed back up. And so you don't get to mix what you put in the atmosphere into the whole ocean, except on the time that you're recycling water into the deep ocean. And that's 1,000 years or 2,000 years based on radiocarbon measurements. So you don't start pulling this amount of CO2 that we put in back toward the ocean sediments, is where it got deposited originally, or sometimes in peat bogs and that became coal. But that takes a long time to happen. And so there's a real sense that the simple model fits to what's been happening suggests that there will be this ongoing rate of decay, but the more sophisticated models don't. And I've been trying to look at that and get some sort of consensus answer. The two sides don't seem to talk to each other very well. And I think one has to worry that the CO2 is going to last quite a long time. A substantial fraction of it will last quite a long time. And we don't really want that to happen. So I think that the case time's more like 1,000 years than it is 50 years, which is.
We will be right back with UK climate videographer Nick Breeze in conversation with well-known American climate scientist Dr. Mike McCracken.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Welcome back. We continue with Nick Breeze of Climate Gen, talking with Dr. Mike McCracken. Nick's video is titled, 2.5 degrees C to 3 degrees C is not viable. Dr. Mike McCracken's case for solar radiation management.
In that sort of time frame then, and if you look at the time frame we have, which is not 1,000 years, it's this period where we have to reduce emissions we have to find a way of bringing down atmospheric concentration of greenhouse gas. I mean, it rather looks like we're going straight through the 2.5, and is 2.5, it's not, as you said, it's not a dial where we can sort of turn it to where we want. It's literally, that's probably a transition to somewhere else. How do you see a vision of this that is actually a pathway to the future that people can believe in, or at least, conceptualize?
The first challenge is just at least having a discussion of it. And right now, the prevailing view has been, ever since the UN Framework Convention, everything, that emissions reduction can do that. And that's what we've got to do. And that's, no question, that's, we want to have it happen, but it's proving very difficult to do. But those of us on intervention are also working on mitigation. I mean, we think that's absolutely essential too. There's a lot of research going into what solar radiation management can do. So the first thing is to get it into the mix of considerations as a supplementary effort. I mean, there are questions of who's going to govern it. My view, my personal view, is that the important reason for doing it is to help alleviate the situation in the underdeveloped and developing world that is most vulnerable. And so it's basically to allow achievement of the sustainable development goals. The United Nations has a whole structure for trying to promote sustainable development goals. And so one could get, if their structure would say, look, we've got to do something and everything, it could draw ideas and input from other UN organizations and make a recommendation to the General Assembly and the Security Council and say, this is what to do, or this is, what can be done. This is an option. And if you go back to 2007 and 8, the UN Commission on Sustainable Development actually asked for advice from the scientific community on how to do it. They were a little not happy, I guess, with the IPCC assessments. What scientists basically say in the assessments is, if this happens, this is what will happen. If this is done, this is what will happen. And they basically asked the scientists, a scientific group, what should we do? Well, scientists are very reluctant to get to the word should, because there's a whole lot of different considerations that come into making a decision. But we did respond to them in a way that said, if you want to get to this point, a condition so you can achieve the sustainable development goals, these are the things you have to do to get there. And so that's where we are again. If they want to achieve the sustainable development goals, there are some things that can help us get to that. Not doing anything and letting the temperature go up to 2.5 or 3 degrees is not the way to do it, and is not a viable approach, at least from our view. There may be people who say that. So I think there is a path that way. It is sort of said also that, well, SRM is uncertain. We don't understand it enough and we should do it. And I guess my response is to say, well, science is always somewhat uncertain. And it is true. There's some understanding, but there's a fair amount of research going into what solar radiation management can do and how it would help limit the intensification of tropical cyclones and do other things without doing significant other adverse effects. There is also significant uncertainty heading into the future without intervention. If you do intervention, we're going back to conditions where the climate is something we've experienced and the models have been tested against, and the models have simulated volcanic eruption effects, which is how one way of trying to do intervention. Whereas going into the future of 2.5 or 3 degrees, the models haven't been run in those conditions before. We don't have verification of that. And sort of the experience has been, as we've been getting warmer, the models sort of underestimate what's happened. They've underestimated sort of the change in climatic conditions of the mid-latitudes. We've been getting more extreme kinds of conditions. They make sense afterwards once you think about it, but the models haven't been picking those up so well. They've been lagging behind a bit. So I guess the question is, do you want to go to conditions that paleoclimatic experience as would be remarkably different and probably unsustainable, up 2.5 or 3 degrees, with potential significant sea level rise and maybe irreversible commitment to very large sea level rise in the future. Do you want to do that? Or do you want to say, well, I want to try and be at where we are or a bit lower in terms of global average temperature, doing it with, say, volcanic, imitating sort of continuous volcanic, starting small and adjusting as we go. There's a really interesting paper that I think is sort of almost coming out, but I heard about it at a webinar the other day, but it basically is an approach for optimizing the pattern of intervention that you would do, where you would put the different sulfate, how much, what seasons, what latitudes and stuff. Optimize it with respect to certain goals you want to achieve. So it could be a temperature increase, but it could be, my concern is doing it in a way that will allow the monsoons to continue. Doing it in a way that will try and minimize very hot heat waves and high heat index kind of conditions. You know, choosing some other goals that will help in reducing the disastrous kinds of effects that have been happening. And so there are ways starting to be able to do that, which it makes it very interesting. Unfortunately, there's hardly any real effort and no negotiating discussion going on at high levels about considering this approach. And that just seems not the right way to go. So we're trying to get attention to that issue.
Can I just cite one issue that a previous guest brought up, which was creating a Damocles world where once you start doing this, we're in a highly vulnerable situation whereby if we stop doing it, we basically could have a whiplash effects which create more harm and destruction.
Well, that's one of the reasons that we want aggressive mitigation. The Damocles sword metaphor is really bad, assuming if emissions controls don't work and if CDR doesn't work. That's where it gets big. If we get good aggressive mitigation, and we get CDR starting to phase in to try and help pull CO2 down as well, or the effect of CO2 emissions down, then the Damocles sword isn't quite so bad. It's a smaller influence. And there's also the issue that I'm not trying to go back to pre-industrial conditions. If I go back to then there's this big 3-degree difference. If I go back to 1C conditions and I can keep it to 2.5, the amount of increase that would happen if for some reason it stopped, you know, would be considerably less. Now, people also say it's going to take money and attention away from mitigation. But one of the aspects of imitating this volcanic eruption is one of the concerns is it's so inexpensive to do that somebody might actually do it. And so it would be a little bit strange for countries to decide to stop doing it. Although if you're doing it for some period of time and people get used to it, they sort of wonder, is that really necessary? Can I stop it? Well, you could see pretty quickly if you stopped it, what would happen. We've just had an example of it sort of with what's been happening with respect to SO2 emissions coming off from ships and forming aerosols. So one of the things I've learned over my, I was thinking back, it's almost 60 years since I built one of the first climate models and stuff, is that climate change is not really random. The significant climate change is a result of something changing the energy balance. Over long times, it's been where continents are in different places and stuff, or it's been the rise of the Central America so that it makes the Atlantic Ocean colder and saltier and sort of drives the overturning circulation. But climate change occurs for a reason. And that's just pretty well illustrated with what's just happened when they've been cleaning up SO2 emissions from ships. And the SO2 concentration and the cloud brightness or even cloud existence in some of these regions has gone down and contributed to warming. So we have pretty good examples of it, you know, that that's the case. So would countries want to stop? Well, I don't know any countries that are really interested in having the situation keep getting worse. There's certainly quite a few possibilities of how it could get worse. But, you know, I mean, if you say, well, maybe Canada and the Soviet Union want to melt areas where there's permafrost. Well, no, not really. I mean, you end up with very marshy land that's hard to get the resources out of. If you're in Siberia, and you potentially could have much more CO2 and methane emissions coming out that would take conditions way beyond where we're headed now. So I don't think there are countries that really want it much warmer, you know, warmer than where we are. I think most would prefer, I'd rather be a bit less. So I don't have, you know, droughts in agricultural areas. So if you look at Russia, for example, and its rain-producing regions, you say, and I've talked to a Russian scientist about this, I don't understand how water gets there to water those fields, okay? It can't come from the south over the Himalayas and the mountains to the south. It's an awful long way from the Atlantic Ocean to get all the way in there, and there's mountains along the way. Where does it come from? And they say, oh, it comes from snow in the winter, and then that snow melts and it adds to soil moisture, and you grow your crops while you have that soil moisture there. Well, if it gets too hot, all that soil moisture evaporates away before you get your crops done. So there are just difficulties for basically every nation if things keep getting warmer and hotter. So I think there would be much more likely to be some agreement to try and keep the levels down. What we have to do is, you know, where there's resistance, if you say, oh, well, you know, the United States is going to go and control the whole thing and do it. And you're going to say, well, wait a minute, I don't have confidence in that. I don't like that. And then that's exactly right. It's why a number of us haven't, you know, we're not pushing intervention early along in the system because the United States has not made the commitment to get emissions down. They were starting to under the last administration. Right now, we got problems. But, you know, if you put it under United Nations control and the vulnerable nations have a real say in what happens to try and achieve sustainable development goals, you know, and it can be not just the low latitude ones. It can be the indigenous peoples of the north and some others and everything. And you would have a real debate. I think the sense would be, well, we don't really want to end it. We want to continue it. We might learn over time that we can, whether we should adjust it a bit below, down toward half a degree, or keep it up near one, or whatever. But those changes could occur slowly in time for groups, you know, to adapt. So you're right. I don't want the Damocles sword to fall and have a sudden 1 degree warming. But the alternative is, I don't think we're going to do very well at all at 2.5 or 3 degrees, where the Damocles sword equivalent is that the ice sheets are going to melt and they're going to cause rapid rise in sea level. I mean, if you look at the sea level projections in the last IPCC report, you see most of the solid lines for what would happen come in at less than a meter by 2100. But then there's this dashed line up there that got put in because in the review draft, the consideration of the review drafts, the scientists who came out with these lines said with high confidence it's going to be less than 1 meter by 2100. And a number of us wrote, including Sir David King and others, we got him to sort of lead in the writing of it, wrote and said, where did you possibly come that you have very high confidence it'd be less than a meter? And they said, well, there's one process we don't understand, okay? Scientists don't understand. And that's flowing ice sheets and calving, okay? So the ice going out that way. We can't model that. So we left that process out. We left that effect out. That's probably going to be the largest effect that will be happening in the ocean or something and having it cause sea level rise. They left it out. And I'm saying, you can't leave it out. You've got to, you know, give some indication. And so we'll put in this dashed line. And then, you know, there is this question of why did you stop saying it 2100? I mean, sea level is going to keep going up once you get it started. The glaciers go to lower altitude as you get it started. That makes them warmer. That makes them flow more. Greenland, existing as a relic of the ice age, it was so tall that it was cold on top, and so it could stay away. Now they're having rain on top, and it's getting warm on top, and that's going to accelerate melting. Once it gets going, it's really hard to stop. And that's 6 or 7 meters of sea level rise equivalent over some time scale or something, a few centuries maybe. So, holy Toledo, why just look at 2100? I'm worried about a commitment to sea level rise and this idea that we can go up to 2.5 and 3. That's the Damocles sword that I'm worried about.
Can you end by, if we took away a sort of a few of the political obstacles that exist today, and we said, you know, Mike, give us a pathway to greater research in the open air and some sort of deployment strategy, what would be your advice?
I think a number of us were looking to the Overshoot Commission that was formed as a way of trying to start getting at this question. That was a prominent group, independent of government, with some important leaders from around the world, former leaders from around the world, taking a look at it. And they pretty clearly indicated that it was likely we were going to overshoot this 1.5 level value from the Paris Accord. And what should one do about it? What's going to happen? What are the consequences? It certainly seems, if you read the IPCC reports of what the consequences are when you get up there, it becomes very severe and intolerable. I mean, the World Bank did some studies maybe a decade ago about the world at 3 or 4 degrees C, and it looked at various places in the world. And if you're in the Southeast Asia, which is low-lying, it basically said sea level rise is going to be a huge issue with salt water coming into all the areas that grow rice. If you look at Africa, the issue of drought is just going to grow and become very severe. And can it provide food for all its people? They looked at, you know, different regions of the country, and all of them were getting to very serious situations. Are there ways to potentially deal with that? You want some consideration by some high-level bodies that are open to thinking about and listening to reasoning about all of this and trying to make judgments. As I sort of said at the start, we're scientists, and when the word should comes up, you got to be hesitant because there's all these other considerations to make. And what we need is some sort of advisory group or body of respected people who will take a look at it and will help getting discussion going in bodies like the sustainable development components of the United Nations to think about, well, what's going to happen if we just can't stop much further climate change, doubling where we are essentially in terms of the increase in global average temperature, with potential tipping points recognized by scientists up there, like thawing of permafrost, which could release all kinds of more carbon and basically take climate out of the potential of control from us, from everybody. So I think we just have to get some high-level discussion. This group I'm with, the Healthy Planet Action Coalition, is really trying to stimulate that, is get some consideration of it. Don't sort of automatically write it off. I mean, what it seems right now is there's this group tied to we can do it by mitigation because the technological potential is there. And that's, you know, that's potentially true, but it's going to take time. There's a lot to do to replace 80% of the world's energy supply, which is what you have to do. And if there's no energy, if we lose energy, there'll be riots in the streets and all kinds of deaths that occur. So, you know, it isn't an alternative that you can suddenly say, oh, I'm just going to stop putting out CO2 and we'll let the world go on. That isn't a viable approach. So can we come up with a credible approach? And a group of us are basically saying, we think climate intervention has to be part of that and has to be something we do. I hate putting this obligation onto future generations. You know, that's, as I say, you know, the United States was considered the issue 60 years ago and early on. It's just, a real shame that the nations of the world have dawdled so long. We've known about this issue for quite some time. You know, there's the young people have, you know, a very strong case to make against what's been happening. One of the things I've done in my retirement is, you know, is help on some of these lawsuits that have been involved in trying to get governments to pay attention. This is a huge intergenerational issue, and we need to be doing something much more about it. And somehow it's no longer the case that mitigation alone can accomplish what we need to do.
Well, look, Mike, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to me about it.
You're welcome.
If you are concerned about the future, then why not travel with me through every COP conference from COP21 in Paris to COP28 in Dubai by ordering my book, COP Out, How Governments Have Failed the People on Climate. In COP Out, you'll gain insights into what is actually going on in these supposed world-saving conferences and how we have ended up in this dire era of dangerous consequences. You can order COP Out via the link in the notes or on any online bookstore worldwide, in paperback or audio version.
That was Nick Breeze talking with Dr. Mike McCracken on why we might need geoengineering sooner rather than later. Nick also recommends his April 2025 interview with Professor Raymond Pierre Humbert on the dangers of solar geoengineering. Find that on YouTube on the Nick Breeze channel, Climate Gen, or Nick's website at gen.cc. That's Jen with two N's, .cc. We are lucky to have Nick finding key climate scientists to talk about their work. I put some links to major voices warning against geoengineering, whether it is tests or one country deciding to change the world's climate, all in my show blog at ecoshock.org. In addition to Humbert, check out what Bill McKibben and Jeff Goodall say. Geoengineering has been covered in at least half a dozen Radio EcoShock shows. Try Shade of the Future, posted May 22, 2024. Longtime journalist and filmmaker Dr. Gwyn Dyer says yes in his new book, Intervention Earth, Life-Saving Ideas from the World's Climate Engineers. Australian author Clive Hamilton on geoengineering, and his new book is Earth Masters. That was back in 2013, but it's still a really essential read. And then going back to 2009 in my show Geoengineering Bye-Bye Blue Skies, top climate scientist Alan Robach lays out a laundry list of reasons why trying to control the climate may not be such a good idea. And way, way back in 2008, newcomer Alex Smith interviewed Mike McCracken about sudden and abrupt climate change. Here's a quick 2-minute sample from that program.
Michael McCracken is the chief scientist for the Climate Institute in Washington, D.C. He's a past president of the International Association of Meteorology and Atmospheric Sciences. Can you begin by telling us what is abrupt climate change?
Well, the general perception has been that the climate will sort of gradually shift as the concentration of CO2 rises in the atmosphere. But I think what we're finding is, and if you look at the historical record, the Earth's history, you see the potential for rather sudden changes, for it to change in jumps and starts. The Earth's sort of a finite size, the wave patterns of the atmospheric circulation can go one way around a mountain, or gradually they can shift and go another way around. And so you end up getting shifts or surprisingly rapid changes. And we're trying to point out that that's much more possible than has been considered in the past.
That was Dr. Michael McCracken on Radio EcoShock in January 2008. All of this from Climate Gen and Radio EcoShock and the media and the science are easy to check out using links in my weekly show blog. It is always free and ad-free at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening this week.
You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby, where you can engage with us via our website at cjsf.ca or on our social media, which is CJSF Radio on TikTok and Blue Sky, or CJSF Music and CJSF Talk on Instagram.
Starting from the week of Monday, May 30th, the Student Union Building is open 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. The sub-building common spaces, along with the bookable spaces, are available for use. Any comments or questions, please go to the Simon Fraser Student Society website at sfss.ca for more information.
Radio